You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 9 of Heritage Voices on Working with Museums. Today, we are very excited to have a panel for you of Indigenous people from across the U.S. and a variety of backgrounds, including archaeology, cultural anthropology, and a TIPO as well, talking about their challenges and benefits that they've seen from working with museums. My name is Jessica Uquinto, and I will be co-hosting this very special episode with Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. The Go Dig a Hole podcast focuses on students and early career archaeologists and is a really good resource for those people that are really just getting started or who've been in the field for a while and just want to learn more as well. He also does a really great job of focusing on issues, including diversity and inclusion. So those of you that like this podcast might really, really enjoy the Go Dig a Hole podcast as well, which you can find at godigahole.com, where he also has a blog in addition to the podcast. And we're also joined today by my co-host, Lyle Bolanqua, but he's going to be a guest today on this podcast instead of a co-host. But for those of you who've been waiting for an episode by Lyle, he has an episode that we're going to be airing next month. So I'm personally just as excited for that one as you are. So stay tuned. It's also focused on museum issues. So if you enjoy this podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this one. He starts to kind of allude to it towards the end. So stay tuned for that and let us know what you think of this episode. We might try and do more of this direction and having panels here in the future. So give us some feedback, let us know what you think, and yeah, hope you enjoy. Thanks.
All right, so to get started, why don't we have everybody introduce themselves real quick? I'll start. So I am Jessica Uquinto, and I'm the co-host with Lyle Bolanqua of the Heritage Voices podcast. And I am a cultural anthropologist and the founder of Living Heritage Anthropology. And I live in Cortez, Colorado.
And I'm Chris Sims. I'm the host of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. I'm calling in from Portland, Oregon. I'm an archaeologist with experience in CRM and in nonprofit educational groups. And I also work for Codify and the Center for Digital Archaeology.
My name is Cassie Rippey. I am the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer and archaeologist for the Coquille Indian Tribe. And we're calling from Coos Bay, Oregon.
I'm Danny Hakama. I'm the cultural anthropologist for the Coquille Tribe, and I'm tribal member of the Coquille and Coos tribes.
My name is Desiree Martinez, and I'm a member of the Gavilano Tongva tribe, and I'm a practicing archaeologist.
Hi, my name is Emily Vanoff. I'm Fiasco Lakota, and this fall I'll be starting my PhD at Indiana University with an emphasis on Indigenous archaeology in North American Plains prehistory.
Hello, my name is Lyle Bolanqua. I'm a member of the Hopi tribe. I've been working as an archaeologist here in the Southwest for over 20 years in various aspects of CRM. And currently I work as an independent consultant.
All right. Well, welcome everybody. And to get us started, we'd like to invite Denny to open up the conversation.
I'd like to sing a prayer song. Short one in one of our tribal languages.
Just a note that ultimately it was decided not to include the prayer song itself within the podcast recording.
All right. So, Denny, thank you for that, first of all. And second, would you like to start out? I know that you've done, Cassie's mentioned that you've recently done some work with museums. So would you maybe like to start talking about the kinds of experiences that you've had in working with museums?
Well, I've been working with museums for a long time. I went to graduate school after my kids were born and at the University of Oregon. And basketry is my thing. It always has been. And so when I got ready to do my program for the end, I thought I would have to go to California because I knew several programs, several museums down there that had collections of our basketry from the Coos Bay area. And then I found out that the local history museum actually had a pretty large collection. And it took a long time to get in there, not because, I don't think it was because they were prejudiced against Indians at all. It's just that they were really old school and had one person running the program, and she had run it that way for a whole lot of years. And she wasn't real anxious to let anybody in there. So it actually took me probably 6 months to get her trust to be able to even see the baskets. And I think the condition the baskets were in is probably really common. They were just stacked together in cardboard boxes. Makes me hurt. So that was my main goal, was to get all those baskets out and housed in the proper manner and all the baskets on display. So that was the beginning. Okay, so that was, what year was that? That was a long time ago. That was probably 97. And they planned a new museum at that point, and they just opened their new museum this last year. It's a beautiful museum, but they don't have space to have all the local baskets on display. And I think that's a problem with museums everywhere that aren't cultural museums, that aren't tribal museums. You know, they have to focus on other things, which is understandable. Mm-hmm. But baskets have spirits and they need to be out. They shouldn't be in cardboard boxes and vacuums. So that's kind of my passion. And I know the problems that the Kahuk tribe have had, and specifically, I think their problems are, well, I know of a local one that they have problems with, but the Berkeley Museum is notorious for not working with tribes well and having human remains that they refuse to deal with. And we have a huge collection of baskets down there that until just recently we haven't known much about. We know the history, but I think, as far as I know, that's worst case scenario, and they have gotten better in the last few years. We actually got to see the baskets last week, and it was pretty amazing. And they are housed well now, and they are being taken care of, but they are not on display and never have been.
I'll just do a quick follow-up. So in addition to the local museum that we work with here in Coos Bay, we also work with the university museums up at University of Oregon in Eugene. We work with the Oregon State University and a number of other university and local museums that we have fairly good relationships with, but it's taken quite a bit of building, trust building, to get to where we're at today.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think can be done to build that kind of trust with museums?
From my perspective, a lot of it's actually communicating and working with the tribes. A lot of museums tend to get wrapped up in the work that they're doing and in the research, and they forget that it's still part of living culture. And so having an open dialogue regularly with the tribes would go a long way in creating a better trust relationship.
Mm-hmm. Since I went to the University of Oregon, I've known the people that work at that museum for a long time, but I really think it's helped with them to get to know us better and to see how much the things that they see in that they handle every day, how much they mean to us. We've done several repatriations of human remains from the U of O, and it's been perfect every time. And the first time we went to get human remains, we did a ceremony at the museum, and we had cedar boughs in the back of the car that we were taking the ancestors home in. And the museum people were shocked. They were just really, really touched at that. And I think it really kind of opened their eyes.
This is Lyle. I think from the Hopi perspective, you know, museums, of course, have been the double-edged sword in terms of the work that we've done. Hopi has done a lot of repatriation work dealing with NAGPRA, but also exhibit designs. The Museum of Northern Arizona has been a big partner in terms of working with Hopi. They're currently redoing part of their ethnography gallery in the museum that's open to the public. And Hopi is a big participant in that right now in terms of what is appropriate information and what should be disseminated to the public out there. Of course, it varies from museum to museum. Some museums have a lot of experience in working with the tribe, and so they have the process down, particularly as it relates to NAGPRA, repatriation of not just human remains, but also items of cultural patrimony, you know, things that are still in use within the ceremonial cycle here at Hopi. And so it really comes down to how experienced that staff is. And I think a lot of it is reliant on the personal relationships that you form with those staff members. I think when a museum has continuity of staff that have been there for a number of years or have worked with tribes throughout their career, I think that really helps smooth things out in terms of their understanding. A lot of the education goes back and forth in terms of how are these items stored within museums. A big issue for Hopi that came out in terms of the repatriation issue is the treatment of items, how they were treated with chemicals and other pesticides and insecticides over the previous years, and what are the harmful impacts that could be passed on to the living practitioners that then take possession of those items. And so for Hopi, that was a huge issue in the early 90s in terms of really, how do we deal with the repatriation of these items back to Hopi, knowing that they are going to be handled by people within the community, knowing that they're going to be still in use. And so a lot of that education on the Hopi part was learning about the different chemicals use. And so, you know, I think it's what that reflects on is just a good communication process from both the staff and the tribal members being honest about to a certain degree about what we can pass on to staff members. But I think, you know, open communication over the years has really helped Hopi in terms of understanding museums and what they do and what their missions are. They're more than just education for the outside people. They also have a responsibility and obligation to be responsible to the community members that they're trying to represent out there when they put up their exhibits and those kinds of issues. And so I think over the years, Hopi has had a good experience with various museums. We still deal with it on a very day-to-day basis in terms of what's going on out there in the museum world. But I think Hopi has come a long way in really understanding how museums work and how that communication can improve over the years.
So I have a few questions that some of the listeners of the Go Dig a Hole podcast might have, since I wouldn't expect them to be as familiar with these issues, you know, being early career archaeologists or students or just interested members of the general public. So there are some issues around repatriation of human remains and also other important items. And so, you know, there are some laws that are in place. NAGPRA is the main one. And there are problems with it. And I think, you know, for anybody not familiar, NAGPRA is the Native American Graves Repatriation Act. And so, you know, it requires that human remains be returned to their descendant communities. And I think this would be a good point to talk about some of the gaps in oversight of NAGPRA and maybe, you know, like how do these remains continue to stay in museums when, you know, like where is the obligation on the museum's part to find the descendant communities? And, you know, like is there a problem with the way that law is structured and the way that museums work with human remains right now? Because it looks like right now the burden is placed on the descendant communities to find human remains and lay claim to them, when it should be the burden on the people who are holding the remains, right?
Yeah, I worked at the Yale University Peabody Museum when I was an undergrad, and my main focus was the ethnographic collection for the Alaska Native tribes, but I was talking to the NAGPRA coordinator, Erin, about human remains one day, and she said that sort of the biggest gap and issue she has with NAGPRA is that sometimes when objects and human remains were collected, they didn't have the right information or provenience wasn't given. And so she has remains that'll be like, oh, these are from North Dakota. Well, there are a lot of different tribal groups that have been in and out of North Dakota. And so she's like, I have to contact a large amount of tribal people who aren't necessarily getting back to me, or I'm not contacting the right person because I just don't have a lot of the information. And I don't know exactly what the solution to that problem might be. And it does have to do with NAGPRA, but it also has to do with sort of this history of collecting in the United States, especially on the East Coast. I think a lot of stuff from the West was collected, but then doesn't have its context or label or information, which can make it really frustrating when institutions and universities are trying to get those human remains or those objects back. So there's just one perspective.
Yeah, that history of collection is I think, a huge problem in creating all these other issues that kind of cascade around from that.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think one of the other issues, too, and one that my community has dealt with, is that we're a non-federally recognized tribe. And so prior to the unidentifiable regulations coming in, we weren't being reached out to because we weren't falling under NAGPRA in terms of who they needed to contact. And so a lot of us as community members were reaching out to museums in order to see what ancestors they had within their collections. But even now that we have regulations for unaffiliated remains, we're starting to be contacted, but again, you know, even with those regulations, federally recognized tribes are first to be asked if they, you know, don't want to be involved in those remains, in getting those remains back. But the other thing too is that we have been dealing with is the history of the academic interpretations of our community's history, stating that we're extinct, we don't exist, that we're delusional Mexicans, and that our community, in particular the Gabrielino Tongva, only came into the Los Angeles area about 4,000 BP. So when you have a law that really rests on preponderance of the evidence that was collected by scientists who do not use the correct research in order to make those affiliations, you start to get not being contacted as well. So there are some museums that stated, because the scholarship on Gabrielino Tongva archaeological history states that we weren't here until 4,000 BP, if we try to make claims of any ancestors that are older than that, then we're mistaken or our oral histories are incorrect because the scientists have said that we don't have any relationships with those ancestors that are older than when we have supposedly come into the area. So we're always fighting against museum personnel who are making those affiliations, and again, using the scholarship there and putting it against what we believe and what we know to be true about our community emerging from this area and being here for thousands of years more than what's currently in the archaeological literature.
And Desiree, I have a question for you there. I've heard of other cases where there have been, especially I believe in the Pacific Northwest, where there have been tribes that are not federally recognized for one reason or another, and that other tribes have basically spoken on their behalf, because NAGPRA, like you're talking about, until I believe it was 2010 that the regulations that you mentioned changed. Has that been something that's been part of your experience, that there's been partnerships with federally recognized tribes in order to try and help that situation? Or has it really been your tribe alone attempting to go directly to the museum?
No, for the last couple of repatriations, actually all of the repatriations that we've done have been through the good graces of our cousins, other federally recognized tribes, not part of our community, Gabrielino Tongva, because we don't have any, but other communities to the north and to the east of us who have made claims on our behalf and then have allowed us to rebury based on our traditional burial practices. But again, as a community that, and if we want to talk about sovereignty, when I'm talking about recognition, you know, we all want to be able to make claims to our own ancestors and not have to depend on another community to do that. But we've done that because we've decided that it's most important to get the ancestors back into the ground as soon as possible, instead of waiting for somebody to decide that, you know, we are have that relationship and should be able to make that claim on our own.
Mm-hmm.
That raises another thing that I've read about and heard, you know, through people who have experienced this, is there are appropriate ways to handle and record information about human remains, and there are inappropriate ways. And one of the most inappropriate ways is to display images of those human remains. And you know, there are a whole lot of issues about that, and museums are often in offense of displaying pictures of human remains. And it's one of those things that it varies group by group. And I think the tradition of museums stemming from like the classical European collections and stuff like that, they make good book covers and they make cool pictures for National Geographic, and you know, they're fun to look at on social media to some people. But taking pictures of human remains is, you know, it's disrespectful to a lot of people, and it's disrespectful to the ancestors. And so you know, I think that issue of kind of handling and recording human remains before they are returned is also another problem that, you know, scientists and some other people get up in arms about.
I've done a lot of work with the Autry, you know, Museum of the America West. Particularly our community has had a long relationship with that museum. And because of that long relationship, and particularly within the last couple of years, we've made strong forward movement with them and trying to understand our perspective for the Gaborone Tongva. We definitely don't like having our ancestors have pictures displayed on the museum exhibits and presentations and stuff like that. But I know in talking with our elders, particularly a lot of us do a lot of education and are trying to help various museums develop educational programming for teachers and docents, et cetera, we've decided that there are some pictures in which we have to show ancestral remains and how they were treated in the past. In particular, for my community, Ralph Glidden, who was a pot hunter out on the Channel Islands, he displayed ancestral remains in his museum, and we show pictures of how he used to display those ancestors in order to tell the history about how the ancestors were treated in the past and how deplorable or horrible those conditions were. Luckily, we were able to rebury all those ancestors last summer, but it's one of those things where it's up to the community to decide what's important. And of course, we do it in a mindful, we've done prayers in terms of trying to find guidance in doing that. And although it hurts to see this, and of course, when we give these presentations, we warn people that this is what we're going to do. And if they object, they can leave at any moment. But it's a teaching moment so that people can understand the kind of travesty and the horrendous experiences our community has had to deal with in seeing this stuff. And then also the ill treatment and disrespect that the ancestors have dealt with. And so finally, in teaching and talking to the museum staff, they finally get it. And there was actually a scholar who contacted the museum to get rights to a picture for an archaeological report that they were writing. And they wanted specifically the pictures of the ancestral remains. And the museum contacted our community and said, do you want us to give permission so that they can use this in a publication? And we said, no. So they turned around and told the author, no, you can't use it. We don't give you permission to use it, because that was the only picture they were going to use. Out of all of the pictures of the artifacts and everything, they just wanted the ancestors. And it's because they wanted that sensationalism. They wanted to show it, you know, to make it a good publication. But that's not how we want to see our ancestors done, for sensationalism. It wasn't for the education of what they were doing in their report.
Okay, so we're going to pause for a moment and take a real quick break. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
All right, we are back.
And I know that Emily, for one, has talked a little bit about, in one of her blogs, about some similar types of issues with the representation of Native American artifacts and human remains. Emily, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. So I wrote this article about the artist James Luna, whose pieces were pretty popular in the 90s. And one of the pieces he did was he displayed himself as like a Native American. And he was just wearing like a loincloth, and he was like buried with his divorce papers and his like record player and all this stuff. So it was humorous, but it also was sort of, you know, talking about like, why are Native people displayed in this way? And do you see other, you know, minority people or just people in general being displayed in this way? And you really don't. It's mostly Native people. And so his work is really interesting, but I think what's frustrating nowadays in museums and museums, especially on the East Coast, is you don't really have people from the West, like tribal people who live out West,
being able to tell these East Coast museums and institutions, like, I don't want you displaying a goat stance shirt, right? Like these ceremonial objects, there's not really anyone to tell them yes or no. And so they just kind of display whatever they have in their collection. And a lot of the time, those are ceremonial objects. And so I think that was one of the most frustrating things for me going to museums on the East Coast. And there are good examples where the Peabody Essex Museum in Massachusetts does a lot of work with tribal communities, which is awesome. But then you have museums in New York, like the Met, that don't have that sort of need to contact tribal members. And it can be really frustrating.
That makes me think again about the issue of the baskets being, you know, displayed improperly too, that they need to be out of boxes and not, you know, stuffed away into boxes. And there are other items that, you know, the issue with display, as far as I understand, or one of the issues of display rather, is that there are objects and items that are sacred and only certain people should be able to see those things. And so there's to have museums, like you had said, putting whatever they have out, you know, without any sort of kind of selection against, like, oh, well, who actually is allowed to see that, is removing these sacred items from their context. And, you know, in that regard, I think it really removes what's special about them. And, you know, to remove, you know, the context of that, you know, kind of really robs the meaning from it.
Yeah, definitely. I personally don't think that human remains should ever be displayed, but I think with tribal consultation, you can kind of suss out what objects should be displayed, who should be able to see those objects. I know that there have been tribes that will come in and be like, well, we don't want you displaying the objects, but if you can keep the objects, certain objects, that would be fine. So I guess a lot of it is like, what can be displayed and what can't be displayed?
What are some of the problems associated with how things are displayed in terms of their interpretation? You know, again, coming back around to how things are removed from context, you know, like one example I'm thinking of is I went to a museum in Tijuana, Mexico, and it was both a great museum and an awful museum in terms of it had just a lot of history of the local area and a lot of history of the region in terms of the native groups there, and also the various different groups that were coming into contact, and you know, all the cultural change that was happening over time. But the way the native groups were portrayed was it was just blatantly offensive, like to see the way they were portrayed with the mannequins standing naked in very primitive poses and stuff like that. And so, you know, to come back around to that, like what are some of the issues with the way these items are displayed and then how they're interpreted?
Well, at the Yale Old Peabody Museum, they're sort of in the back, which you don't see out in the actual displays of Native objects. But in the back, there's like overarching, I guess, almost themes or labels for objects. So all the Plains tribes are under Sioux. Like you have Crow, Hidatsa, Arikara, Pawnee, Cheyenne, Lakota, all under the guise of Sioux. And then you have anything that is like Northwestern Plains under North, like the Northwest and into Alaska, as just Eskimo. So a lot of the times, like the very specific tribal nations, because there's over 500, is just gone. It's just not there at all. It's not properly labeled. But then a really actually like good museum that I went to this summer was the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, the Plains Indian Museum in there, was awesome because they labeled everything tribally specific. They had people from each tribe elders talking about the objects. So it can be done, and it can be done in a really good way, but I've also seen it where there's just the complete erasure of tribal identity. So it's kind of, I've seen great and I've seen bad across the U.S. So.
Yeah, so we actually just completed a project with the University of Oregon in Eugene. One of the complaints that we'd had about their exhibit at the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology was that when you walk in, you see the exhibit and you think, oh, well, here's this past culture that died, you know, as soon as the settlers came in. And so we and the other tribes here in Oregon partnered with the museum to update their exhibit so that in addition to showing the plank house and the baskets and the arrowheads and all these little artifacts, it included interviews with tribal elders, and it included maps showing where everybody is and activities that they're doing today, with videos and interactive displays to show this is a living culture. They didn't die out as soon as the settlers got here. We are still here. And so that exhibit opened up, it was November last year. And so we were really excited to get to see that partnership grow.
That's awesome. And it sounds like, sorry, go ahead, Lyle.
I was just going to say, yeah, I'd like to follow up on that. I think that's one thing that's a really positive that I see in terms of how museums handle the consultation process when it comes to the appropriate types of information, is that you can, from my perspective, you can kind of see the level of consultation that a museum has done based on what types of information they're showing. You know, like some folks have talked about going to some museums and kind of getting the really ethnocentric viewpoint, you know, where we're just all Native people are relegated to the past, versus a different museum setting where they include those living voices with, you know, the archaeological record there. And so it's really important for museums to understand that, like many people have voiced, that we are living cultures, that the living descendants still carry on, you know, this knowledge and tradition of what they are exhibiting, particularly as it relates to something from the archaeological record. It's really important to show that, you know, the tribes are still here. The folks that are descended from these people are in fact still around. And so, you know, here in the Southwest, we deal a lot with, in the past, we deal a lot with this theory of the vanishing Anasazi and that kind of thing, when all along the Pueblo tribes have been waving our hands kind of in the background saying, well, we're still here. And so I think it's a positive step that we see museums or other exhibits, like in visitor centers, like in some of the national parks, where they've really made that concerted to include the modern perspectives, so that folks, the visitors that come and see these exhibits, they're getting the understanding that these people didn't just disappear, that these cultures are not totally void of any meaning to anybody here in the modern day, that it still has a lot of meaning to the folks that are still carrying on these traditions. And so I think it's important that museums consider that, and those people, the young students or whoever are coming into this kind of career, really take it upon themselves to remember that there are still living folks here, and that it's important to engage them and throughout that whole process of exhibit planning, so that you're not just getting the one-sided perspective. You're not just getting the story that the archaeologists tell you, but you're getting multiple perspectives about who these people were, what they later became, and what they're doing nowadays. So, you know, just to follow up on previous statements there.
That's great. And it really highlights the need for, you know, accommodating multivocality, you know, bringing all of the different voices and perspectives into telling these stories, and, you know, really bringing it to life. And it's not just because it makes for a better story, but it's also, you know, it's more respectful to the people involved. Okay, so we've heard a few really good examples of the right ways to do things. We've also heard a few examples of the wrong ways to do things in terms of museums holding and displaying and interpreting Native culture. Are there some examples of programs or museums that serve as a model for the future, or, you know, something that is successful that other, you know, museum programs and so on and so forth should follow. 'Cause it sounds like the example of, University of Oregon's, Oregon State, Museum, has made a lot of steps in that direction. Would you see that one as being one that other museums should follow along?
In some ways they do a phenomenal job. In other ways they still have a lot of strides to go. So, you know, I guess it's a starting place.
What are some areas that they could improve on?
And we can speak to that more generally, not necessarily calling out one particular museum. What are areas in general that all of you have seen that you think museums could improve on?
Well, I want to talk about my work again with the Autry Museum of the American West, and it's something that's been happening within the last year and a half, and we actually have a publication that's coming out in terms of conservation. So we happen to have, and this is all outside of NAGPRA, there are some ancestors that were removed from a site in Southern California, and when they were removed, unfortunately, they were removed whole with the dirt surrounding them, and then they were covered in, I don't want to say glue, but I can't remember the material, but it basically covered the whole ancestor as well as the dirt to keep it together, and then the ancestor was put on display like that. So the Autry was going to move its collections from the Southwest Museum campus to their new facility, and in order to make sure that the ancestor was stable in order to be moved, they started to think about, okay, well, if we removed this material from the ancestor, will it make it more fragile, et cetera? And then thinking about, okay, well, what would happen if we were to do this? And so they actually contacted myself and another community member who had previous relationships with the museum and said, okay, if we remove this, when we remove it, we're going to be actually removing pieces of the ancestor. So do we go ahead and do this, or, you know, what do we want to do as a community? So thinking about, you know, past museum practices and then trying to think about, well, the museum has to care for them until they can be repatriated, you know, bringing the community in to talk about the different conservation methods and then asking the community what they feel would be appropriate. And so for us, when we pass on, we should have every piece of us with us in order for us to complete our journey on the other side. And if you're going to be removing this stuff that's on the ancestor, pieces of the ancestor are going to be coming off. And so, you know, we also don't want to do worse harm to the ancestor. They've already been treated horribly. So with a decision with the community that we were just going to leave the ancestor alone for this move. And of course, we'll probably end up making a different decision when it is time for the ancestor to be reburied. But in particular, for this particular reason of the moving, we decided to leave the ancestor alone at that time. So bringing in Native community members for conservation talks, I think, has really never been done. And we're going to be talking about this at the conference for the International Museum Tribal Archives and conference in New Mexico in October, but it's something that I don't think has really been talked about, again, outside of NAGPRA, outside of, you know, all of these other kind of hot button issues, but just the everyday practice of museums taking care of their collections, particularly as it relates to conservation, I think is kind of unique and something that I think should be emulated.
That is a great example. And that reminds me of something that I think, Cassie, you had mentioned before we started recording this episode about the laws regarding what happens to artifacts and or how museums hold those things, you know, what happens to them. And I was wondering if you could speak more to that, you know, aside from human remains, you know, there's various laws, you know, federal and state level on, you know, how things are held.
Yeah. So I'll first start by putting out a plug. I don't know if you guys are aware, but Department of Interior is currently reviewing NAGPRA to streamline the process
Be a lookout for that while we're talking about it.
Streamline's not a fun word lately.
No, so be on the lookout. That's one issue that's kind of on our minds right now. So the state of Oregon has they've done a really great job of working with the tribes to try to do their best to protect cultural resources. In fact, we just did an update to our Cultural Resources Protection Act. Senate Bill 144 was signed just a few weeks ago that increased protections for cultural resources. It's now 100% illegal to collect artifacts on public lands. And it adds for more ability to do prosecution for anybody that has been collecting. We also have regulations that require permits to do excavations, especially within known sites. One of those requirements is that when you're going out to do an excavation, you have to designate a curation facility. You list on your permit the temporary curation facility. So where is it going to be housed while you're doing your processing and while you're doing your report writing? Mm-hmm. After your report's completed, where is your permanent curation facility? For private lands, you have the option to return it to the landowner or send it to one of the designated museums that's approved by the state. For public lands, it is required to go to one of the designated museums for the state. Up until recently, the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology at University of Oregon was the only designated facility for the state of Oregon. So anything that came from public lands or didn't go directly back to the landowner went straight to OSMA. That was an issue. They've recently opened up a couple of other curation facilities. Oregon State University is on that list. Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology is on that list. I think there might be one other, and I can't think of what it is. But one of the things that we all notice immediately from the tribes is that the tribes are still not on that list of designated repositories. So if a landowner, say a private landowner, wants to return the artifacts to the tribe, they have to say, we want the artifacts back, and then they have to privately donate them to the tribe. They can't specifically designate, this goes back to the tribe. If it's on private property, public property, say a state park, we know that there's an excavation on the state park, and we know that this is a sensitive site. We're going to say, we would like to have those artifacts back. The state says, well, you can have the NAGPRA items, but everything else is required by law to go back to the designated curation facility. And for us, that doesn't work for us. So one of the things that we're trying to change, push for, is to see state of the tribes be listed as designated curation facilities, not only on private property, but also on public as well. Something that I've noticed, I noticed immediately when I started being as an undergrad, museums and archaeologists claim ownership of the collections that they work with and the collections that they take in. They're not just stewards, but it's their collection. I'm working with it. It's my collection. And it's a great thing to want to be a great steward for that collection and to take pride in the fact that it's being well protected and cared for. But it doesn't belong to that researcher or to that facility. Remember, it's just a continuation of me harping on that. This is a living culture. These are living people, and we want to have those things returned to us in many cases, not in all, but in many cases, we want to have those things returned to us.
So, okay, real quick, one clarification. So basically, it sounds like this Oregon law is meant to be a supplement to the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, or ARPA?
Yeah.
At a state level, or?
Yeah, the state laws mirror and supplement a lot of the federal laws. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And one thing continuing on what you were just saying, one thing that I heard of recently, because I was having a very similar conversation not too long ago, that there's some tribes that have gone through the process in order to become curation facilities.
Yep.
You know, not basically just that it can be returned to the tribe, but that they've actually opened a curation facility in order to avoid that discussion entirely, basically, which right. obviously leaves the question, or several issues, I guess. Yep. First one being that at that point, they're still not quote unquote the owners of those materials, because they're still then federal, like in federal hands, they're federal property, I guess you'd say. Right. So what do you think of that solution?
Well, you know, a couple of tribes here in Oregon have done that. One tribe, and I won't name which ones are which, but one tribe tried doing that and was actually turned down because they still continue to use at least the tribal artifacts as living works. And so there are certain sacred items that they would check out to tribal members for ceremony, and they didn't pass as a curation facility because it's not staying in that facility. And so tribal museums and tribal collections, we view, you know, those collections differently than the state and the federal process does. But you know, I mean, it's one way to work around the system. But it comes with a whole host of other obligations, financial obligations, space obligations, and other things that at least our tribe right now isn't prepared to take on. We don't have the staff or the funding or the space. So it's great if a tribe can do that, but it comes with a whole host of other obligations that it's really kind of unfair to put that burden on the tribes, I think.
Right.
Yeah, not to mention the costs associated with opening a you know, repository. That's a significant investment.
Currently, Hopi is in the process of we don't have a museum per se, an official tribal museum. We have no curation facilities, no repository. All of our items related to NAGPRA, we have to enter into agreements with the institutions, museums, universities, so that they can continue to curate those items until such time that Hopi can find a suitable or build a suitable repository for those. This process here at Hopi has been ongoing for probably 30 years, you know, and we're at the stage now of actually having some really definitive planning going on right now. There's a tribal resolution supporting this museum idea. But it's going to take a lot more work for it to you know, become a reality. And part of that struggle is the cost associated with it. You know, the original estimates back in the 70s, this idea first came around, of course, are probably triple or quadruple what those amounts were originally estimated to be at. So we're looking at the millions of dollars. And so right now, Hopi has to rely on the good faith efforts of other museums and institutions to continue to hold those items for Hopi more or less free of charge. And we know that places a huge burden on those institutions all throughout the Museum of Northern Arizona, again, simply because they're a really good partner for Hopi in terms of understanding our needs and our limitations in terms of budgets and staff and space, all those issues that any museum would have to go through. And so we work with them as such to hold certain items. Some items are held separately, you know, like sacred items or religious items are stored different in apart from NAGPRA items, say funerary objects. We don't want those two things being stored in the same storage space. And so we worked with those institutions to come to that kind of agreement. But yeah, for Hopi, it's a huge issue. We have thousands of items out there, you know, in the outside world being held by other institutions. Some of those items come back, like I talked about, the repatriation part being returned back to the community. So those more or less get reabsorbed, you know, by the community members and are put back into use or stored elsewhere. But yeah, for Hopi, it's a huge issue in terms of how do we deal with those kinds of issues down the line. How much space is going to be needed? You know, our initial estimates of what a repository may look like keep growing in size once we start to realize the number of collections. And we're not just talking about NAGPRA items. We're also talking about fine art collections that people want to donate to the tribe. You know, probably any given day of the week, our cultural preservation office here gets a phone call from somebody saying, hey, you know, my grandfather collected all of this stuff for 50, 60 years and we want to give it back. Where do I send it to? You know, so people are ready to ship boxes and boxes to the Hopi tribe, but we have nowhere to put it. And so for us, that's a huge issue that we're dealing with. And we have to rely on those good faith efforts from some of the museums and other institutions to hold those items for however long it takes for us to, you know, build a suitable repository. But yeah, I think for those tribes that have the space and the museums already in place, you know, I think we look to those folks as models in terms of how we proceed down the line with establishing our own Hopi Tribal Museum and repository. What does that look like? Is it more, we're not really calling it a museum. It's more or less termed a learning center because it's not so much about showcasing to the outside world. It's more about cultural preservation. And so we want it to be a facility where folks from the community can come and hold classes to teach aspects of the culture or tradition, language, arts, what have you, you know. And so that's kind of the big idea for us. But yeah, dealing with the museum aspects of just where and how do we store these items has been a huge issue for us that we're still trying to wrap our heads around in terms of how much space we need.
Okay, so we're going to take our final break real quick. And then when we get back, we will just jump right into it.
Interested in archaeology? Want to hear from experts in the field about the latest discoveries and interpretations? Check out The Archaeology Show every other Saturday and let hosts Chris Webster and April Camp Whitaker take you deeper into the story. Check out The Archaeology Show at www.archpodnet.com/archaeology and subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and the Google Music Store. That's www.archpodnet.com/archaeology. Now back to the show.
That space issue isn't just a museum problem, and it's not just a tribal problem. With the state law that we have, it gives you a deadline on for your archaeologist, it gives you a deadline on your permit. And the state tries to follow up with all those permit holders and say, hey, have you turned in your artifacts? Have they gone to your curation facility? But there really isn't any teeth to make sure that that's being followed through on. In my previous life, before I started working for the tribe, I was doing contract CRM work. And one of the firms that I worked for had boxes of materials in their storage facility dating back 10 years because the curation facility was full and there wasn't another approved designated facility. So they just started housing materials there. I know of firms in this area in Oregon that just hold on to material because they figure, well, we'll turn them all in bulk at some point. It's just easier because it's, you know, maybe a 4-hour drive to the closest repository and it saves money to turn everything in maybe once every 2 years or something. So the storage issue and the curation issue isn't just on museums, but it needs to fall as a reminder to the CRM firms that they also house temporarily, hopefully, but they also house these collections.
Yeah, that is tricky because it's like, of course, the tribes want their items back, and they want, you know, everything repatriated. But then there's the issue of space, and even like you had pointed out at the state level, you know, even state recognized or federally recognized repositories don't even have the space. I worked in the southeastern U.S. doing CRM, and there were a few states that even their state repositories were under constant threat of being shut down for just funding, lack of space, lack of proper, you know, management of the humidity, stuff like that. So it's a really complex issue that, you know, needs, I think, as several of you have pointed out through the course of this conversation, it requires, you know, building deep relationships and keeping open communication and, you know, just keeping that communication going and understanding each other's needs. Like Lyle, you had pointed out, you've got a really good relationship with a university there in Arizona that they understand kind of the limitations of what you're working with there. And so it seems like maybe that would be a good path forward for, you know, these cultural items is, you know, to focus not solely on the item itself, but to focus on the relationship with the tribal people.
I think that's an important part. You know, people come and go in terms of their careers. People retire, they move on to different jobs. There has to be a good philosophy, an overall mission of both sides, you know, so that there is a clear path for those who come and succeed, you know, those folks who move on. So we may establish good relationships with one professional at a museum or a group of professionals. When those folks move on, sometimes we have to go back to square one and we're left trying to reestablish those lines of communication. And we're hoping that that relationship that we've built upon in previous years and previous efforts carries over to whoever comes on board next. And so I think having a clear track record, being very transparent about how tribes and institutions interact with one another helps set that transition for, you know, hopefully it makes it smoother. Of course, there's always going to be some obstacles when new people come on and the learning curve of what do they know, where were they previously employed, what is their experience in terms of dealing with tribes. So sometimes, you know, you have to go through that learning process all over again, but hopefully, you know, that track record of your relationship with a museum or other institutions is clearly laid out so that there is something to build upon. And so I think that's one thing Hopi really stresses is that, you know, we're not going anywhere. We're going to be here for a long time. That's our hope. And so in doing so, any work that we do in the current age has to be able to carry forward, you know, into the future generations. And so not just in terms of cultural preservation, that's our burden that we have to carry forward. But the burden on the institutions is to have that open line of communication and be willing to communicate and know that it's a two-way street in terms of how they, you know, interact with tribal nations. And so beyond individuals, you know, you try and establish that very solid foundation. So hopefully as the things move forward into the future, you can continue working, you know, positively.
Has anybody on the line ever done an MOU with a museum? I know that's something that we're trying to do with the Autry.
We had one with our local museum, but neither the museum or the tribe really pushed we didn't really push the meaning of that MOU, and it expired last year. And we only accomplished about half of the things that we had intended to on that MOU. And I think it's probably time to revisit it.
I was going to say that Hopi have an MOU with the Museum of Northern Arizona. It's something that we revisit periodically. And it really relates to, again, that storing and curation of items there at the museum and how that, you know, just the finer points of how that all works out. I don't know if we have MOUs or MOAs with anybody else. That's the one I'm most familiar with. But again, it's something that both the museum and the Cultural Preservation Office here, they periodically review that document. It does expire every 4 or 5 years, I believe. And so, you know, when it gets close to that expiration date, we re-enter consultation efforts to see if there's anything that needs to be changed wording-wise, the obligations and responsibilities from both sides, if there's any changes to those. But for now, yeah, it seems to work fairly smoothly.
Yeah, the Hopi the Hopi agreements with the Museum of Northern Arizona and just all the other tribes that they've worked with as well are really, really interesting. It's a really interesting case study because I feel like a lot of you have touched on, like Desiree touched on, for example, the fact that just because something negative was done in the past doesn't necessarily make it better to take that thing away. And I feel like a lot of you have touched on similar unexpected things that come out of consultation, like Denny talking about, no, we do want our baskets out of boxes and displayed. So I think that just goes to highlight and the Museum of Northern Arizona being another example where they, and I'm sure Lyle could speak to this a lot more than I could, but one example of one thing that they do is they have, there was concerns about objects not getting any sunlight and that, you know, basically as living spirits, these artifacts weren't getting sunlight and what they needed. And so the museum set up a way that at least once a year, every object within their repository would see sunlight. And so I think one of the, I mean, I think the key point, like Chris was saying, out of this conversation today so far is that the importance of consultation is not just, you know, I think a lot of archaeologists or museum people see consultation as a way to learn about the artifact itself, but that there's so much more to it than that, and that you can't go in expecting any certain one response, and that the consultation may lead you to really unexpected and really, really positive for everybody places.
Yeah. And that takes a lot of flexibility and kind of, you know, placing the needs of others first. Well, I feel like that might be a good point to start wrapping up the episode. Is there anything else that you all would like to share?
Has anybody worked with the Smithsonian as far as repatriation of human remains? I spent 2 summers at the Smithsonian in the archives and the National Archives, and it was a really good experience. And going in, I thought that if anybody would have their records in order, it would be the Smithsonian. Well, I'm sure a lot of people know that's absolutely not true. I was shocked, absolutely shocked. They said they had nothing from Coquille or Coos or even the Coos Bay area. And we got permission to start looking at artifacts, and they opened a drawer, and, you know, a huge drawer, and everything in the drawer was from our area, because the records were just so bad. But that ended up, we brought a lot of information home and shared it with all the tribes in Oregon. But just recently, the Smithsonian has, they don't have to follow the NAGPRA laws, but we just recently found out that there are human remains from our area there. And so far, it's been just an amazing relationship. It's worked really well. We're just getting started, and it's very slow. They warned me that it would take at least a year, but that part is really organized and very, very positive. So I'm hoping it turns out as well as it started.
That's great. And do you feel that they're putting in the work to build a relationship with you to, you know, make sure everything is done right by the tribe?
We're just getting started. They, of course, don't know anything about the tribes out here, but so far it's gone well. And I'm just wondering if the whole thing is going to be as easy as it started out. And in the past, it just brought up something. My uncle was an anthropologist too, and he went back to the Smithsonian for the first time in like the 70s. And he started asking, he had friends from the Klamath tribe, and that it was known that there were remains taken from the Modoc War, and those people had been trying to get their ancestors back for years. And so he started asking back there, and finally was told to go into this office, and the osteologist, they were sitting in his office talking, and he said as soon as he walked into the room, he knew there was something wrong in that room. And the guy said, well, turn around and look up. And there was five skulls on the top shelf with their names on their foreheads. And he eventually got those back home. But, you know, even the famous institutions like the Smithsonian sometimes don't know the right thing, the right way to do things.
I think these interactions with museums are important for the general public to understand, because I think non-tribal people see museums as almost infallible, like they are the gold standard for you know, these repositories of information and knowledge, and you know, when you visit a museum, everything is going to be, you know, displayed correctly and in, you know, the way it should be. And the knowledge that you get from there is totally accurate and verified. And you know, this conversation we've had today really highlights the need for multivocality and for tribal people to be involved in that process. And you know, that there are things wrong with museums, and you know, there are examples, as we've heard, of museums doing things the right way. And you know, like you had pointed out, it's a start, and it sounds like they've got still a very long way to go. But I'm really happy we've had a chance to have this conversation today and hear, you know, these perspectives, and you know, explore the problems with museums and see, you know, that there is kind of a path forward. And you know, by no means is this like the end all be all for the conversation. I think that we could talk about this for, you know, our lives probably.
Yeah, just to close out on my part, you know, issues and obstacles and even the successes, you know, those have to be revisited time and time again throughout whatever process we're going through. And so I think that's, you know, what I spoke about earlier, is having a good track record, being transparent, but also having a good paper trail about how this process moved forward, you know, so that we're not continually having to start from the basics. When I talked about new people coming on, I think it helps to have that, those documents, those MOUs, whatever you have in place to revisit, so that people can understand what has been done, what were the obstacles that, you know, we had to encounter and work through. Do we have to revisit those issues again, or can we just continually to move forward and know that, you know, we're not starting over from the basics. Sometimes you have to, sometimes issues come up and you have to, you know, kind of start at the very beginning and move forward again. But I think just for both sides, both museums and the tribal entities, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to have that open line of communication and be willing to share information to a certain degree, you know, and be willing. And if you have to share information that may not be suitable for the public, making that known. But I think it's about education on both ends. I think tribal communities appreciate the work museums are doing in helping to preserve our cultures And there's a lot that we can learn from them. You know, one aspect is pursuing these as careers for our own tribal people. So having those relationships in place, I think, is a positive step to having our own tribal folks enter those fields and then come back and work for their own communities. So I think that's, you know, as museums and tribal folks move forward, I think it's something to keep in mind.
That's great. Cassie and Denny, do you have anything that you'd like to close out with?
I don't think so. I think that, wow, pretty well covered it.
Yeah. Emily or Desiree?
No, that was perfect. That's exactly what I would have said.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, it was great having you all on the show, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences and your thoughts. You know, I'm really looking forward to, you know, continuing any conversations that, you know, follow from this. For any of our listeners, if you would like listeners to get in touch with you, you know, where can people get in touch with you?
This is Cassie. I'm always happy to have people contact me. My email address, it's the CassandraRippey@CoqueWellTribe.org.
I'm always checking my Twitter. So Emily Van Awesome is my Twitter handle, but I always check my email too. So Emily.VanAlst@gmail.com. VanAlst is VanAlst.
People can contact me through my email, Lyle.Boenqua@gmail.com. Last name is B as in boy, A-L-E-N-Q-U-A-H.
People can contact me on my email, which is DesireeRM@gmail.com.
And my email is DannyHockham@CoqueWellTribe.org.
Okay. And all of those will be in the show notes as well.
Yeah. And Jessica, you're on Twitter as well. You're at
Living Heritage A. And then my email is Jessica@LivingHeritageAnthropology.org. And Chris?
Yeah, and so people can track me down on Twitter, in Instagram, it's just @GoDigAHole. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/GoDigAHole. My email is Christopher@GoDigAHole.com. And like Jessica said, all this information is going to be available on show notes. If you don't see it in whatever podcast player you're listening to, then you can find the show notes from the stream on Go Dig a Hole on the blog at GoDigAHole.com, or for the Living Heritage podcast, you can find it on ArchaeologyPodcastNetwork.com and search for Living Heritage.
Heritage Voices.
Sorry, Heritage Voices.
I know that Lyle and Emily at least both have blogs as well. I don't know if either of you wanted to put in a plug for your blogs.
Yeah, I write for Working It Out Together magazine. It's actually a First Nations Canadian collaboration online publication, and there's a lot of other really great articles about issues affecting Indigenous communities, but I'm actually the first North American Indigenous person to write for them. And so I kind of cover anthropology, archaeology, working with Indigenous communities. So definitely check it out.
My blog is called Angles and Momentum. It's anglesmomentum.wordpress.com. I write generally about anything dealing with Hopi in terms of CRM. Also, my work as a river guide, I throw some things in there about outdoor education. So, yeah, I'm not a very prolific writer, but I do get some stuff up from time to time. Thank you.
Basically, outside of the podcast, does anybody have anything that they want to add? Any thoughts, any concerns or anything?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. Are you guys, are any of you, I mean, one thing that Lyle and I had talked about, and I'm sure Chris would probably be interested in as well, is maybe doing some more of these episodes, picking a topic and just having a group of people talking about it. So if any of you would be interested in maybe doing some more at some point, or if you have thoughts on what you would want to talk about or topics you would want to explore. Yeah.
Sure, I'm down for it. Just keep me updated.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. I'm super down.
Cool. Well, this was a lot of fun, so I'm really looking forward to keeping in touch with all of you.
I don't know if anybody'd want to go, or if they're interested, or if they would want to go in this direction, but last week we went to see the baskets at Berkeley, and we also went on a tour of Alcatraz. And the biggest thing that struck me about Alcatraz was a picture of at least 20 Hopi men that were put in prison because they refused to send their kids to government school. It was really amazing. And so, boarding schools, that's a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a couple people that have already, through the Coalition of Indigenous Archaeology Facebook group, that have expressed an interest in talking about boarding schools. So I think that definitely we could do one on that. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you so much for taking the time again. It was great talking with all of you.
Okay, we'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes,
Stitcher, or the Google Music Store.
Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.